We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls. One of this past summer's biggest news stories involved a confrontation between a college professor and a police officer. Now, it is likely that this story would not have been anything more than just a local story for the media and the people of Cambridge, Massachusetts, where it took place. But in this particular case, the professor is African American, the officer is white, and further, the professor is an internationally known scholar at Harvard, Henry Louis Gates. Confrontations like this happen regularly, no doubt, across the country, although few receive so much attention in the media. It even drew in the President of the United States, who called it a teachable moment and invited the men to come down to the White House and have a beer. Question is, it may have been a teachable moment, but did we learn anything? In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about some questions involving media, race, and policing in the United States. And we have two guests here to be with us on the program. Both of them are on the faculty of Loyola University of Chicago. Robert Lombardo is a sociologist. He is assistant professor of criminal justice and member of the graduate faculty at Loyola University Chicago. He's been teaching there starting as an adjunct in 2001 and went full-time in 2005. Has his PhD from the University of Illinois at Chicago. He also served 30 years with the Chicago Police Department and five as the deputy chief of the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department. And he's worked in all areas of police work, including patrol, investigations, narcotics, administration, organized crime. Also joining us this morning is Don Wycliffe. He's a longtime Chicago journalist. He was an editor for the Chicago Tribune and has taught there at Loyola since the fall of 2008. Most recently, he served as vice president for news and information at University of Notre Dame. Before that, was public editor of the Tribune from 2000 until 2006, and then editorial page editor from 1991 until 2000. He's also worked at a number of other papers and has taught at a number of other places, including Notre Dame and Roosevelt University and Columbia College. We're glad to have the two of them joining us this morning. They're both joining us by telephone. And as we talk, as always, people who are listening are also invited into the conversation. Comments and questions welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try and be brief, just so we can get as many in as possible. But certainly your thoughts are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, Professor Lombardo, hello.
Good morning.
And Ms. Wycliffe.
Good morning.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. You know, we started thinking about this, I guess, some time back, and I suppose we were interested in trying to find out if there was something could be said that hadn't already been said in connection with this incident. And I guess one thing that did interest us was the level of coverage that it received. And I'm interested in maybe starting there and getting your thoughts. And maybe I will start with the journalist, Don Wycliffe, and ask you to just reflect for a little bit on how much attention the incident itself received, and then how that grew into a much larger conversation about race in the United States.
Sure. Most of the attention stems from the fact that the President of the United States weighed into the issue when he was asked by a former colleague of mine, Lynn Sweet, at a press conference, his views on the Henry Louis Gates Officer Crowley confrontation, and the President. I suspect he regretted it afterwards, but he asserted that he thought the Cambridge police had behaved, quote-unquote, stupidly, arresting Gates after they had determined that he was legitimately in his own house. And so you can't magnify any situation more greatly than when it gets the attention of the President of the United States in a national press conference.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to Robert Lombardo. I guess I'll ask you the same question. I'm sure that you read the news stories and you saw the discussion that was attached to this incident. I wonder what you thought about the kind of coverage that it got.
Well, I agree with Professor Wycliffe. I mean, certainly the president's involvement certainly created a wider audience than this incident probably deserved. I don't think there's any question about that.
Do you think that it did say something important about how the issue of race gets tangled up with dealings between citizens and police officers?
Well, certainly. I mean, it was not only race, but it was also the notoriety of the professor. I mean, he's a well-known and distinguished man in the educational field, and people are also aware of him in the popular literature because of his writings, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. Even if he had not been African-American, the fact that he was such a famous person, so to speak, would have created news attention without a doubt.
Mm. I think the coverage produced a little bit of light, frankly, owing to the fact that after the president had said what he said, after Professor Gates' version of events was out there for several days, Officer Crowley came forward with the support of a number of his colleagues, including several black police officers, and it turned out that this guy and, frankly, the police in Cambridge were a bit more complicated, there was a bit more nuance than we're accustomed to. You know, you see the videos on TV of two cops wailing away on some black kid, and it just looks ridiculous. In this case, you had a guy who had been involved in diversity training and things like that, and was highly thought of by lots of people, black and white. And so it added a little texture and nuance and made the conversation a lot more interesting.
Well, I do think it's worth noting, as some of the coverage did, that it may be somewhat ironic or I don't know what word to use, that this took place in a community that has a reputation for being politically liberal, mm-hmm. for having trying at least to take a constructive approach to these issues. And in addition, that Cambridge has an African-American mayor and the state has an African-American governor. That, you know, it seems a little surprising. Well, maybe not surprising that it happened, but somehow, maybe the problem was that at least initially there wasn't a lot of detail about what happened, and that then that gives anyone the opportunity to write their own story, to write that in a sense, I mean, in their heads, write their own version of what happened.
Exactly. And frankly, we had on one side Professor Gates, who Professor Lombardo quite rightly calls distinguished in many ways. Man's incredible, an incredible scholar. But I think what this brought to attention was something that complicates all of these discussions. Is that there's a history in this country of frankly, the police being an agency, whether formally or not, charged with keeping black people in line. In a certain way, that attitude, even for a guy as distinguished and well-known as Henry Louis Gates, has kind of made its way almost into the DNA of black people, so that, you know, you assume you're going to be treated a certain way by the police, whether it turns out to be so or not.
Well, I would turn to Professor Lombardo, being both a sociologist and former police officer, and I am not trying to start a fight between you and Don. So don't think that.
Well, I would like to add a comment.
Yeah.
I mean, immaterial of a race. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know all the details. I don't know what happened. But in my experience, any person, again, immaterial of race, that reacted in a negative fashion towards the police are not going to respond. It'll probably push them in a certain direction. And apparently that may have been what happened. If Mr. Gates or anybody else verbally assaulted the officer, not I'm saying that he did, or resisted in any type of way or acted in any confrontational manner. I mean, it's the nature of the police to respond, you know, with authority. And again, I agree with Don about the DNA factor. You know, some black people are probably afraid of the police, or they have had experiences in the past or historically have heard about negative confrontations with the police. But again, in my experience, and today we have a quite different police department than we had 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, throughout the country, police are well-educated today. They're hopefully professional, trained to be professional. They're aware of these problems. They have cultural sensitivity training. But my feeling is that the police would have probably asked Mr. Gates to come into the station, no matter what his color was, if he reacted to them in an unfriendly or an angry type manner.
The police officers, you know, we have to say, obviously, they're human and are capable as capable of making mistakes as any of the rest of us. And on top of that, there is the fact that in their dealings with people, there's always got to be the element in the back of their heads that there is this potential threat to them physically. I'm sure that officers are trained to be cool. No, to try to be cool and calm, and no matter what. But I guess I wonder how far training like that can really go, whether that's just you can't expect a police officer to be superhuman in dealing with people.
You know, again, I wasn't present there, so I don't know exact details. But it's not beyond police operational procedure. Let's take it into the station, let's talk, let's get somebody else involved, let's get the lieutenant or the captain involved, let's get an additional opinion here, let's get somebody that's not angered by the situation involved to influence this whatever decisions are going to be made. So I don't know what transpired between the two of them. Only the people that were there probably really know. But the fact that he had actually ended up into the police station, I don't think is totally contrary to police procedure.
And I think, in fairness, I think to everybody, I think that afterwards, everybody, when things had sort of cooled down, I think that probably both of these men said that, yeah, they overreacted, and perhaps maybe if they had, both of them had conducted themselves a little differently, it wouldn't have ended up being what it was.
Sure.
I'm interested in having Don Wycliffe just talk some more about though the problem here that everybody brings to the situation, or the history that people bring to the situation, and what you can do about that, and if it's possible to do anything just right at the start that would defuse something like that. And obviously, this only got to a certain point, but things could one could imagine things could have come out even worse.
Well, frankly, not having had experience as a police officer, I don't know. But I can't help but believe that the sorts of things Professor Lombardo has talked about, better training, sensitivity training, that sort of stuff, has to help. And frankly, the presence of more African American and other minority officers in departments may have some sense of, what the sensitivities are. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing has to help. But in the instant of a situation like that with Professor Gates and Officer Crowley, I don't know what might have made a big difference. Not having been there in the first place, and then not had the experience of a police officer.
Yeah, do you think that that this this story was, it was a big story for a while, as is the nature of things. Then people talked about it and talked about it, and then the guys got together and have their beer, and then we kind of went on to something else. Do you think that that the media maybe missed an opportunity to do something a little bit more meaningful with this issue?
I I'm not sure what they would have done, what they could have done. You can always, do special reports on police training and that sort of thing. Frankly, I think the atmospherics and the injection of the president into the thing probably, if you could say, took things off track. The injection of the president lost maybe the teaching moment for us.
Well, I think that it's interesting that it even got to the point where the president was being asked about it, because it was perhaps it was because Professor Gates is a well known national figure. Maybe that's the reason, but it was sort of my understanding that it even took a while for the story to catch on, and it was actually first really picked up and reported by the Crimson, wasn't it? By the Harvard University College paper, and then from there it kind of took off and became a national story. One could really imagine that this would have been maybe a local story and getting some attention, but then having it stop there. And one wonders how it even got to the point where during a presidential news conference, a reporter asked the president about it. And then he, as you say, I think that he probably later wished that he had not said what he said. And normally normally he's really good. I'm sure that immediately he said, he thought to himself, maybe that wasn't the right thing to say. But at that point, it was done.
Yeah, I can't now recall the circumstances as to how the story, became a story. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't comment on that.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, and maybe I'll just very quickly introduce again our two guests. Don Wycliffe, longtime editor for the Chicago Tribune. He worked as the editor of the Tribune, public editor of the Tribune, from 2000 until 2006, and also as its editorial page editor. He is now a distinguished journalist in residence at Loyola University of Chicago. Also joining us from Loyola is Robert Lombardo. He's a sociologist, assistant professor of criminal justice, member of the graduate faculty at Loyola University of Chicago. He is also a former Chicago police officer, 30 years with the Chicago Police Department, and 5 as the deputy chief of the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department. Questions welcome at 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Two anecdotal stories that I think may shed some light on this discussion, or at least stimulate the discussion. Back in the late 60s, my mother was then studying for her master's degree in library science, and came by the undergrad library one day, she and a couple of colleagues, to remove some audiovisual equipment that they were going to take someplace, in their personal cars and so forth. And sure enough, they're schlepping this stuff out of the building, and a university policeman rolls up and says, what are you doing? And, of course, they smile and say, this looks pretty funny. Let us explain. Which I don't understand Mr. Gates doing at any time during this confrontation he had with a policeman, which, as I understand it, the reason he was arrested wasn't because of what happened in the house, it's because he followed the officer out of the house and was shouting at him in the street. Another is that about that time, too, late 60s, early 70s, some characters stole a motorcycle and put it in the back of a pickup truck. It fell out of the back of the pickup truck in front of my parents' house. My father calls the police. The police come. They investigate. He's standing out there talking to the police officer. The police officer asks him for my father for some identification. My father became livid. This is where I live, blah, blah, blah. My father was also quite white. My point being is that Mr. Gates didn't, and what little I know of the story, didn't very calmly say, oh, I know what this looks like, so on and so forth. And there are other people, a lot of other people, including a lot of white people, that just really have a chip on their shoulder when it comes to interacting with police officers. Any contact with them is seen as problematic, and they're hostile, and they got their backs up already, and for just the most reasonable things, you know, like I was talking to my father, I said, Dad, why don't you just give me your freaking driver's license? You know, what was the big deal? So, your comments, please. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'll start with Robert Lombardo. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, I wasn't at the Gates incident, and not to dwell on it, but, you know, if your caller's correct and Mr. Gates followed the policeman outside and, you know, and was verbally abusing him, so to speak, I'm not surprised that he was arrested, if, in fact, that's what really happened.
Hmm. Don Wycliffe?
I think it was the very fact that the officer had established that Gates legitimately in his own home that caused the president to say what he said. I think your caller, though, those situations he presents, especially as regards his father, are interesting. His father's the good citizen trying to do right, call the police about the motorcycle, and no doubt was frustrated. Why am I being asked to identify myself? I'm the one that called you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're not always entirely rational in the moment. And I suppose probably police officers get training in exactly how to handle such people. But it isn't just a black thing. It isn't just a racial thing. It is aggravated by that, however, because of a lot of unfortunate history. I can understand his father's frustration. At the same time, I wouldn't want to have been the police officer on the other side.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I want to ask Robert Lombardo, does the law say something specifically about what kind of conduct is expected of citizens in their dealing with police officers? I mean, I guess that the long and the short of it is, are we required to be polite?
Well, I think the only law that would apply would be disorderly conduct laws. And, you know, and there are also some that believe, though, that, I mean, you can't disturb the peace of a police officer. And, you know, police officers are typically trained to, you know, look for another complaint. And if this witness or a citizen said that this person is disturbing the peace, well, then, of course, there would be grounds to arrest that person. Again, people do get arrested for lack of a better term, contempt of the police as disorderly conduct. You know, whether or not that's going to hold up in court is another story. But again, there is an element of, depending on what type of verbal abuse occurred, for example, if you threaten somebody, I'm not saying that Mr. Gates did, but if you say to somebody that, you know, I'm going to do harm to you, you know, in your rage or yelling for whatever reason, and you say, well, I ought to kick your butt, you know, that's an assault. That's a crime. And, you know, if you were even to do that to a police officer, of course he could arrest you for that.
And wouldn't, I guess, again, it's, you know, it's easy to talk about how something like that should happen from the outside, not being a police officer and not being in that situation. But I guess my sort of feeling is, well, shouldn't the police officer be able to rise above that? I mean, shouldn't at least the, you know, if the citizens are being stupid, if they're being a jerk, shouldn't the police officer be better than that?
Well, typically they are. But again, if a situation develops, at least in my experience, where it's disturbing the peace of other people, I mean, taking it into the police station to resolve the incident on the street is not unusual. As a matter of fact, it's probably a good judgment call. Why, if you have someone screaming at you, whether they're right or wrong, it could attract a crowd, it could incite other people to take some other type of violent act. You know, police are trained to, let's quell the situation as quickly as possible, let's get it off the street, let's sort it out at a place where our investigation will not lead or incite further acts of whether they're criminality or outbursts of of unpleasantries or violence.
How much training, maybe this is a difficult question to answer, how much training in interpersonal relations do police officers get, you know, as in among all the other things that they have to learn?
Well, I mean, every police academy is probably different, but for example, in Illinois, by law, police officers must receive cultural sensitivity training. And the typical types of things that are involved in cultural sensitivity training are just the makeup of your particular area, your community, the values of diversity. You know, they talk about human rights and discrimination, stereotyping and profiling, of course, sexual harassment. These, and again, in Illinois at least, cultural diversity is mandated by law. In every police academy, we have, I believe we have like six police academies in the state, and every one of them must follow a legislatively mandated curriculum.
All right, let's go on to some other callers. We have a number of them. Line four is next. Hello.
Line four?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. I hope I'm staying on track. I don't want to distract from the subject, but I'd like to relate an experience I had with no names and none of that with police. Small town near a large town. I, in my earlier years, was a light delivery driver who drove mostly at night, high security job. I left a larger town with my next delivery in a smaller town through a smaller town than that. And one stoplight, car in front of me, I pulled up, and the light changed, the lead car moved, I moved, and here comes a police officer. Pulled me over. I had my items for delivery in the back of the station wagon I was driving. I turned on my dome light, had my driver's license in my right hand, the other hand on the wheel. He came to the car with a loaded weapon at my head, a huge flashlight in the other, and asked me why I was following the lead car as closely as I was. And I said, I didn't know I were that close. And he then ordered me out of the vehicle, threw me over the trunk or over the hood, shook me down. And, of course, I was not armed. A comb was all I had in my pocket. And he said, get in that automobile, and you get out of this town the way you got in here. And I started to say, but I have to go, he said. I told him I had to go to the next town. That's what I was going to say. He didn't give me an opportunity. He said, get out of this town the way you got in here, and I'm only going to tell you this one time. So I turned my vehicle around and went back to the larger town where the sheriff's department was. I walked in there, identified myself, told them who I was, and what I was doing, and what I had just experienced, and they said, okay. They put a sheriff's car in front of me and one behind me and led me through that town because I was a route. The routes were laid out by the company that I worked for, and I had no alternative except country roads, and they didn't allow that. So the sheriff's department led me through there to the edge of the town, and I went on about my business. I was well shaken, as you can determine. But I never changed my route pattern and continued to use the town, and I never saw that cop again. And thankfully, I didn't, because I didn't know what to expect. I called my superiors in Chicago and told them what my experience was, and they complimented and said, you handled it right. If you got a six-shot revolver up your nose, you're not going to say much of anything. And that's the way that was handled on my side and on the police. And I then evolved a great contempt for uniforms, cops, clubs, guns, and all the stuff that they do nowadays with shaved heads and sunglasses. I mean, it has become an egregious statement about social mores among humans. Thank you, and I'll ring off.
Well, okay. I don't know how how one might respond to a story like that. Professor Lombardo?
I don't either. It's a shame he hung up. I mean, I would like to have asked him why he thought it happened. I mean, based upon what he's presented to us, either obviously there was something going on in that policeman's mind that wasn't explained to the driver. I'm not making an excuse for him, but, you know, obviously they were looking for a suspicious car, a wanted offender, somebody driving a truck like that that just committed a crime or a robbery. I can't see the officer just pulling him over for no reason.
What would you say, I wonder, to anybody, not just, I guess, thinking of this person specifically, but anybody who would say today that mostly the thing that they feel when they see a police officer is they feel afraid?
Well, you know what? I was a policeman most of my life, and I still get stopped, let's say a traffic violation or whatever, or if I'm speeding down the highway, I see a police car, I get that tinge of fear, or if a policeman pulls me over, I get apprehensive. So, I mean, I just think that's natural.
But why? I mean, if you're speeding, that's one thing because you know you're breaking the law. But if you're not, why would you?
The first thing you're going to say is, "What the heck is he stopping me for?" Right?
We have a number of other callers here, and we're a little bit past our midpoint. We have two guests. They're both on the faculty of Loyola University Chicago, Robert Lombardo. He's a sociologist. He's assistant professor of criminal justice, a member of the graduate faculty at Loyola University Chicago, and as I mentioned, is a former police officer, was 30 years with the Chicago Police Department, 5 years as the deputy chief for the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department. Is also joining us by telephone, also on the Loyola faculty, is Don Wycliffe. He's currently a distinguished journalist in residence, someone who has been in the newspaper business as a reporter for a long time. He worked at the New York Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Dallas Times-Herald, the Chicago Daily News, and also served as the public editor and the editorial page editor of the Chicago Tribune. Has joined the School of Communication faculty at Loyola in the fall of 2008. And we started out trying to talk a little bit about the big story of last summer, that is, being the encounter between Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates and Officer James Crowley, the police officer. I'm sure you'll remember the story. Mr. Gates came home, had been traveling, was having a hard time getting into his house. A neighbor called and said she thought maybe this might be an attempted break-in. The police showed up, and there was this kind of angry confrontation between the two. Eventually, it became a national story. Maybe in part because at a presidential news conference, a reporter asked the president what he thought. The president said something he probably shouldn't have. And it all ended up in a meeting, the famous beer summit involving the men at the White House, where the president invited them to come down and sit down and talk. And a lot of people said it had some important things to say about race in this country, about relations between police and citizens, and maybe it also has something to say about media. That's kind of what we thought we would try to talk about and why we got the guests that we have. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And so let's talk with some other folks. Philo is next to your line,
hello.
Too. Yes, hello.
I grew up in Chicago. My seven brothers, five became rich accountants, but two became cops. My father was a cop too, so I know it's you may even have known him. But anyway, he was probably an old style cop. You know, he died 40 years ago at 56. But he my brothers and I, the cops are I'm an educator, so or not so, but. For whatever reason, we are miles apart politically, but we do talk a lot about some of similar problems with them. One who's a little older than I retired early. I retired early. Both of us with a sense of frustration and disgust because although I had spearheaded multicultural books in my library and had organized Black History Month for years, the problems that I faced, and to a much more threatening degree, my cop brothers faced, is the lack of or the sense that when someone walks in and sees me and I'm white and I'm blonde, there are some people who see me as the enemy. And although, you know, I'm not a descendant of slave owners, and I'm the automatic perception among some African Americans, and also the bend in the schools are to teach cultural diversity, but never to teach that maybe there should be some sensitivity on all sides. In other words, I felt often a victim of racism because people perceive me as, oh, you must be a racist because I was judged by the color of my skin. And my brothers found this out too, that automatically they had to overcome, the first thing they had to overcome was this hurdle, not only as a white man, but as a white cop, which was a much bigger hurdle than I had to overcome. And I guess I'd like to see in the schools, and in general, some education about tolerance on all sides and on all levels. Because when we teach cultural diversity, a lot of times it's just that people of color have been downtrodden and therefore we're the enemy. You know, that as if some white cultures, you know, white is not just, white is a pretty broad spectrum. I'm not Caucasian. You know, my mom came over on the boat and my grandma and mom worked as maids, you know, so it seems that there should be some more education on that level. And I don't know, I'm not being very articulate, but I wonder if you could speak to that.
No, I think you'd be quite articulate, and I appreciate the comment. And I don't know what, let me just invite Don Wycliffe. I don't know if you have any particular thoughts, particularly about the issue of, you know, in people's dealings with one another, what do you do with all that history? You can't just say, well, that's the past and this is now. But how constructively you deal with that history?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's this sort of thing that has been the goal of efforts at integration and multiculturalism and everything else since I was a kid back in the 1950s. I mean, the whole idea is to get people to see beyond their history, see beyond their little group, and recognize others as human. In some cases, it's harder for some than for others. I as a black person myself, I have had a fairly privileged educational life and a good career. But as I said right at the beginning, there is that fear, that sense of that I feel in the face of police. And sometimes just in the face of a white person's accent that causes me to expect a certain kind of negativity. I'm sure it's stronger for a lot of black people who've grown up in circumstances where, you know, they haven't had near the privileges I had. So, sure, we all ought to do better. God willing, we will in the future. But, I can't make excuses for people who may have mistreated this lady, but you do have to understand.
Yeah. Professor Lombardo, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, sure. I'd like to. I mean, there's discrimination against the uniform. I don't think there's any question about it. You know, people react to police in a negative fashion. And I don't think it's deserved. Certainly some mistakes have been made. But one of the things I'd like to mention about the policing and police departments, like the military, they are some of the most important institutions of integration within American society. You have young people from all walks of life enter the Army, enter the military, enter police departments, particularly your large city police departments. People young people that have never been exposed to people of different cultures or different races or different ethnicities, and you're put together and you work together and you work together as a team. And let me tell you, you come away with friends that are of different races and different colors and different ethnicities to you, and the bonds that are created through that working environment are just incredible and very rewarding to the individual person, but also, I think, very constructive for society. And then these are the same people that are accused of being these agents of discrimination within society. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying police have never discriminated against anyone, but in my experience, the police have done a tremendous job serving minority communities. I remember being a policeman before we had affirmative action, before we had large numbers of minority officers. Who do you think was working in the inner city servicing and helping these people on a daily basis? They were white officers, and they should be commended for all their efforts.
Well, do you? I want to ask specifically about one thing, that the concern about how police officers are conducting themselves, particularly if we're talking about white officers and people dealing with citizens of some other racial or ethnic group. Some people have said, well, at the very least, we need to get a handle on things like how many people are being stopped and who are they? And so we're collecting those kinds of statistics as a way of trying to determine, well, is there profiling going on or not? Do you think that that's a helpful thing to collect that kind of information?
You know, I've read some of the racial profiling reports that were mandated by the Illinois legislature, and I've also read the report that was done by the Chicago Police Department. And there are some differences. I mean, the state, the reports indicate some problems in parts of the state where more minorities are stopped by the state police than whites. Now, again, these are pretty superficial documents. I mean, from a sociological point of view, they don't essentially control for every positive variable that could contribute to that. What's the cause? I couldn't tell you. It could be related to geographical area. It could be related to lack of sensitivity. I mean, I really don't know, and it'd be unfair to criticize the state police for that. But it does indicate that some work probably needs to be done. And again, this has gone all the way to the governor, to the state legislature. Attention has been given to this problem. Solutions have been mandated in the form, like I mentioned earlier, of legislation that demands, that requires that police officers receive cultural sensitivity training and training related to racial profiling. So great efforts are being made within this state to correct any potential problems that may exist.
All right. We have maybe 6-7 minutes left. We have some other callers. Let's go to line one in Urbana.
Good morning.
Yes.
2 points. First of all, thinking about Professor Gates' reaction, I think we have to acknowledge that as Americans and as a country that arose from English roots, even if it's out of historic memory for a lot of us, it's in the culture that a person should be secure in their own home. Among the questions that agitated the colonists as early as the French and Indian War was whether British troops could be quartered in their homes with impunity. And that was as strong an agitating factor as taxation without representation. And certainly in our laws today, there exists a very strong defenses on people coming onto the premises, either as officers of the law or not, of the private individual. The second thing is that there's a point that's hard to remember when a person is agitated. Whatever excites your imagination or anxieties when that blue light is, red light's flashing in your mirror, there's a problem with agitating or flustering an armed man or woman that it's just risky. And we ought to have the self-restraint to, you know, kind of, if we're not being pushed too hard ourselves, to kind of step back from all of the civil rights defenses and arguments that we want to raise, simply to realize the humanity, the weakness of all humanity, and the possibility of that person in uniform having a bad day, or being ill-trained, or even prejudiced. It's just the attitudes that we're, that parts of society are inculcating, that when a policeman presents himself, it's an occasion for some kind of civil disturbance or a defiance. And I'll leave you with that.
All right. And Professor Lombardo, you got any thought about that?
Well, certainly it's a different perspective, but I like his closing comment that some people may take the fact that the appearance of the police as a excuse for civil defiance. I don't think many people do that, but again, I think people are upset when they get stopped by the police, and maybe it's just fear. Maybe we as the police haven't done enough to educate the public about, you know, the role of the police within society. We should be happy to see the police sometimes, not apprehensive all the time.
Just a quick question, because we, in part, we're kind of talking about media. I'm just concerned, interested now to ask you, as someone who actually was a police officer, if you you consider the kind of images that people have of police that come to us through media, and I guess mostly I'm thinking of not news media but entertainment media, that people's in, you know, probably for most people they have actually little or no contact with real police officers, so that what they see police officers doing, they see them doing on television, and whether that has given people some sort of strange or wrong impressions about what police officers are like, and that then that can be a problem if they actually ever meet a real police officer in the course of his or her duty.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. You know, it boils down to, you know, do we think the media and the press treat the police fairly? And in Chicago, I think the Chicago Tribune, for example, in all deference to Don, treat the police fairly well. They're very professional in their reporting. But also, I mean, if you just look at the nature of the news media, and there's been studies done of news media, that, you know, the old adage, if it leads, it bleeds, certainly I think is correct. I mean, people like exciting and different stories. It makes good news. Scandals make good news. There's no question about it. I think the media, we should be grateful to the media that they do expose social problems and political problems to the public. Without the balance provided by the media, I think our society would suffer somewhat. But in the same token, I'd like to see more positive reporting by the news. You don't see a lot about the accomplishments and the good things that the police do. You typically, from time to time, see that the bad things the police do. And again, it's not just the police. I think that applies to our military. You have to turn on the news every night after dinner, and you see all the problems that we're having in Iraq and Iran. I'm sorry, Iran, Afghanistan. From time to time, you see something about the good work that's being done by our soldiers over there. You'd like to see more of that.
What do you? Well, real quick, I guess now I got to turn to Don Wycliffe and ask about what you think about the image of the police officer in media, particularly when news outlets like the Tribune, for example, or others are reporting on cases of alleged police misconduct.
Well, maybe this is just, you know, a difference in perception. I think, frankly, most media coverage, entertainment and news of police, is very positive for the police. I think every once in a while you get one of these cases like the police officer beat up some woman in a bar or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think those are almost always presented as the exception, and I think people understand that. But I think the fear of police is genuine, and it stems more, I hate to say, from personal experiences than from TV portrayal. Hmm. Like the gentleman earlier about talking about driving his route and being subjected to you know, arbitrary treatment by a police officer. I think that's what pops into the mind of any individual who sees those lights flashing in the rearview mirror. Here I am. I'm going to be facing someone who is armed, and I don't know how reasonable that person is going to be.
That's again. I guess I'll go back to Robert Lombardo. That must be, as a former police officer, that must be a little bit distressing, that somebody would have that kind of mindset, that they would, you know, that they'd see those flashing lights and suddenly they start worrying that this is a person they don't know, you know, how they're going to conduct themselves. They don't know what to expect. But one thing they know is that this person has a gun, and is, under certain circumstances, is entitled to use deadly force. Does it concern you that people are, again, I guess it goes back to the question I asked before about how you feel about so many people seeming to be afraid of the police, even if they know that they haven't done anything wrong?
You know, it sounds like this question revolves around traffic enforcement, and it's something I never did in my whole career. The kind of people that many, I don't want to say most, it may have to do with your assignment, your police department that you work for, the geographical area of the state. You know, policemen in high crime areas aren't stopping people for traffic tickets. You know, they're stopping people for a reason related to, information regarding a crime or something of that nature. And a lot of the people that police stop are people that are, so to speak, into life, and they know the game. It's the innocent people or the working people or the non-criminal element, so to speak, that's probably more apprehensive than, quote-unquote, the bad guys out there when they're stopped by the police. And, you know, police do that. I mean, part of the police responsibility is, in fact, traffic enforcement, and if they see a serious traffic violation, it's their responsibility to stop somebody. I've never, you know, even as a police administrator, I was never one for strict traffic enforcement. I mean, there's plenty of crime to fight. But, again, you know, serious traffic violations do cause accidents and potentially deaths, and those types of violations have to be deterred.
Well, we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take. We've just come to the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guests. Robert Lombardo, he's a sociologist, assistant professor of criminal justice, member of the graduate faculty at Loyola University Chicago. And Robert Lombardo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also from Loyola, Don Wycliffe. He is now a distinguished journalist in residence. He's a longtime editor for the Chicago Tribune and has written for a number of other papers, including the New York Times, Chicago Sun-Times, Dallas Times-Herald, Chicago Daily News. Don Wycliffe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This show, Focus 580, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information at bodyworkassociates.com. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. And that's it for us. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll go to the archives and rebroadcast an interview with journalist Bill Murphy, Jr. He is the author of In a Time of War, The Proud and Perilous Journey of West Point's Class of 2002. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat, 557, down 4. March, 573.5, down 3. Chicago December wheat, 558.5, down 4.